write this book, Why Women Should Rule the World, not because women do things exactly like men or are the same as men, but often because of the many ways that women are different than men. I think we get a better look at our problems. I think we get more creative solutions. I think we bring more perspectives to bear, and I think we get better answers.
Good morning, and welcome to the Miller Center Forum. As some of you may know, my name is Cristina Lopez-Guitardi, and I am the new assistant chair of the Forum program. I'm thrilled to be here to begin expanding new research and programming at the Miller Center. It's a pleasure to introduce and moderate my first forum for someone whose life and career serves as a role model to modern women, a theme that is at the very heart of her new book. Dee Dee Myers requires no introduction, but I'll remind you a bit about her background. She's a graduate of Santa Clara University and was the first woman, and at the age of 31, was one of the youngest people ever to serve as White House press secretary. Before joining the Clinton campaign in 1991, she worked on local, state, and national campaigns, including Senator Dianne Feinstein, Governor Michael Dukakis, Vice President Walter Mondale, and Los Angeles Mayor Tom Bradley. After leaving the Clinton White House, Myers became a consultant to the NBC series The West Wing. She also spent 2 years as the liberal co-host of the CNBC talk show Equal Time, discussing political developments. Currently, she is a Vanity Fair contributing editor and is a political commentator on NBC and MSNBC. Today, Ms. Myers will be discussing her new book, Why Women Should Rule the World, a title that I find very convincing. Ms. Myers will be signing books following the forum. Please join me in welcoming Dee Dee Myers.
Thank you for that introduction. It's great to be here at the beautiful University of Virginia. As I was getting ready to come and speak with you all this morning, I was reminded of a story that I heard recently about one of my favorite Washington characters, Rush Limbaugh. Now, it seems that old Rush was in Washington not too long ago, and he was out jogging along the Potomac River, something that he does a lot, I think. He's a big jogger. Anyway, he was going along, and he came on these three girls who were riding their bikes, and they recognized him, and they waved. And he was very flattered that these young girls recognized him, and he waved back, and somehow he became very distracted by all this, and he slipped, and he fell into the river. Well, not to worry, because the girls saw the whole thing, and they raced over on their bikes, and they pulled him out, and they revived him. And he was so grateful, he said, "Girls, I'd like to do something for each of you." And the first girl thought about it. She goes, "Well, I could use a new bike." Rush said, "Done, we'll send one right over." And second girl thought about it. She said, "Well, I'd like to go on your radio program when I get bigger." And he said, "No problem, as long as you're not a liberal." And the third girl thought about it, and she said, "Mr. Limbaugh," she said, "I know this is a tall order, but you're a powerful man." She said, "I'd like to be buried at Arlington National Cemetery." And Rush looked at her and he said, "My goodness, you can't be more than 10 years old. Why in the world are you thinking about where you want to be buried?" And she said, "Well, when I get home and tell my mom who I just saved..." Now, the truth is that joke has nothing to do with anything. I just like making fun of Rush Limbaugh. I know this is a sort of a bipartisan audience. It's not a political event. So in that spirit, I'll try to keep my jokes bipartisan. But I want to warn you, the Republican jokes are going to be a lot funnier than the Democratic jokes. Now, I'm actually here to talk about my new book, Why Women Should Rule the World. Subtle, don't you think? Very subtle title. yay. Then we'll take questions, and in the Q&A, I really encourage you to ask me anything. Questions, comments, insults, all welcome. And about anything, about the book, about, is there anything going on in the political world right now? I don't know, I haven't been paying attention for the last, year and a half. Anyway, I came to write this book, Why Women Should Rule the World, in the aftermath of the last presidential election. It was 2004, and as I painfully recall, President Bush was reelected by a fairly narrow margin. But it wasn't just President Bush's reelection that had me kind of despondent, although that might have been enough for me. It was really the state of our politics. I really felt at the end of the last election that both sides had worked hard to sort of build a majority of 50% plus one rather than a coalition or a consensus around which we could govern and move forward to solve some of our problems as a nation. And all the aftermath of the election was red states and blue states and all about what we had that divided us and not what brought us together. And so I decided I was going to address this problem and address my despondency by writing a book about consensus, about the issues that unite us, about what can bring us together to solve problems and move us forward. And so I wrote my book proposal, and I went around, and I got a publisher, and I started to do the research on this book. And as I began to think about what it would take to bring us together and to move forward in a different direction, I started to look around and say, is anybody doing what I'm talking about here? Is anybody actually practicing what I'm preaching? And as I looked around, I realized that there were some places where it was happening. And one of the places that I thought it was happening in an interesting way was among the women in the United States Senate. Now, granted, it's not a big group. There was only 14 then. There are 16 now. But and on paper, these 14 women had nothing in common. They were liberal and conservative. They were from big states and small states, both coasts in the middle. Some were married and had children or grandchildren. Some had never been married. And yet, these women actually looked for opportunities to work together. They looked for areas where they could agree to write legislation or sponsor a resolution or work toward a solution to a problem. And as I began to think about this, all of a sudden it occurred to me, that's the answer, women, more women. So I called my editor and I said, okay, I'm going to forget the other book. I'm going to write a book called Why Women Should Rule the World. To which she said, okay. And then I went, oh my God, now I got to write a book about why women should rule the world. What am I going to say? So I said, well, I think it has made a big difference when there have been more women in positions of authority. And I think that more women would continue to make things better. But I don't know if I can prove it. So I said, well, let me see what I can find out. So I set out to do the research. And I interviewed a lot of women. That was a really fun part for me. I traveled around the country and I talked to different women in different professions. I looked at the studies and the articles and the books about it. I thought about my own experience and what that taught me. And at the end of the process, or as the process continued, you'll be shocked to know that I found out that I had in fact been right all along. That I think more women has made and is continuing to make the world better. It's not a panacea to all of our problems, and I know the title, like I said, is a little provocative. I certainly don't suggest anywhere in the book that women should rule at the exclusion of men. I don't think that would be any better than a world in which men sometimes rule to the exclusion of women, because I love men. You know, I married a man. My dad is a man. I gave birth to a little man. I don't want my son to have any fewer opportunities than my daughter, but I don't want my daughter to have any fewer opportunities than my son. So my thesis is really that more women in positions of power, in positions of in authority across public life, will make things better, not because women do things exactly like men or are the same as men, but often because of the many ways that women are different than men. That we bring a different life experience, a different way of addressing problems, different sometimes ways of leading and managing, different strengths, different ways of leading. And I think when you take all, sometimes different ways of resolving conflicts, and I think when you take all that women bring and you put it on the table alongside all that men bring, I think we get a better look at our problems. I think we get more creative solutions. I think we bring more perspectives to bear, and I think we get better answers. When you put all those qualities together, I think we move forward in a positive direction. And again, this isn't about, my argument isn't about political correctness. It isn't about let's just kumbaya, hold hands, and bring more women into the process because it makes us feel good. It's about self-interest. I do believe that it makes things better, and I certainly through my research found much to bear that out. In business, for example, business has become more profitable, and I think will continue to become more profitable with more women. There's an organization called Catalyst, which looks at women in business. And they studied a number of corporations across a number of different fields. And what they found was companies with the most women in senior management and on their boards were substantially more profitable, almost without exception, than those with the fewest. Now, they're not exactly sure why. Again, they think it's because maybe a diversity of perspective. I think we need more research to understand all the reasons why. But it was substantial, something like 60% higher return on equity and a 50% higher return on investment. That's not just a little bit better. That's a lot better. That's in all of our interests. In a world that's increasingly competitive, where we need more brain power to compete and win, it doesn't make sense to exclude half of the population from positions of leadership, certainly at a time when, you know, women are now receiving certainly bachelor's degrees. You know, 55-60% of undergraduates at universities that are graduating are women. So we need to tap all that brain power. We need to tap all that energy and that creativity in order to make us more competitive and continue to be more competitive around the world. I think it also makes government more representative when you bring women into the conversation. One of the women that I talked to in the process of this book was Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison of Texas. And she told me about how when she was a young woman and she was working in Houston, she was contributing to her IRA. And then she got married and she moved to Dallas with her husband. And she was temporarily not working. And all of a sudden she realized she could no longer contribute to her IRA. So later when she became, when she was elected to the United States Senate, one of the first things she did was get together with some of the other women from across the aisle and on her side and write something called the Homemaker IRA, which was legislation to allow people, men and women, people who weren't working full-time to contribute, because that makes sense that people should be able to contribute, whether they're stay-at-home moms or people who are temporarily not in the workforce, to contribute to their own retirement. And that wasn't that people had consciously excluded stay-at-home moms from retirement plans, just nobody had addressed it. That's a great example to me of how you bring in somebody who's had a different life experience and we recognize a different problem and we solve it in a way that's in everybody's interest. It certainly, I think, makes bringing more women, empowering women economically and politically, will make the world develop, I think, we will develop economically in very interesting and important ways. Study after study shows that if you empower women economically, they take that money. This is like the micro-lending programs around the world we've heard so much about in recent years. They take that money, and not only do they take care of their children and their families, they invest it in their communities on things like clean drinking water and infrastructure that makes the whole community stronger. So again, it's not just for them and their own families, although that's a lot. I mean, the children of women who have a little bit more money in the developing world are much healthier, have higher birth weights, and they're way more throughout childhood. Very important development. So I think Amartya Sen, who's the Nobel Prize-winning economist, says that empowering women economically is the single most important thing we can do to promote freedom across the world. Certainly in issues of peace, bringing women into peace processes, empowering them, not only helps resolve conflicts, but then it helps sustain the peace and hopefully avoid conflicts going forward. We've seen it in places like Rwanda and South Africa and Bosnia, where getting women involved in conflict resolution has had tremendous positive impact. So again, bringing women into the process isn't the panacea. It's not going to solve every problem overnight, but I think there's no question that it moves us in a positive direction in almost any way that we can think of. So if it's such a panacea, if this provides so many wonderful benefits, then why hasn't it happened? Why are there still, you know, only 16% of our national legislature, of the Congress is women, and only 16% of our governors, and so few CEOs of Fortune 500 companies? I had to ask myself, if it's so clear to me, if it's so obvious, then why aren't people just hiring women across the board? And I had to take a good, hard, cold look at the reasons, and I found I sort of divided it into two sets of reasons. One are kind of the external obstacles, and the other set is kind of the internal obstacles. The external obstacles are the things that we've been hearing about in one form or another for the last, you know, couple of generations. Women are judged by, I think, often a different standard, for example. There is a sort of double standard that women face. And I found a lot of research to bear out that's still true. And it still is a significant obstacle to women. I think women have to do more to be judged equal. I'll give you a couple examples. Many of you may have seen studies about musicians. You know, for time immemorial, most of the musicians, the vast majority of the musicians in the world's great orchestras were men. And the reason given was always, well, men are just better at playing music. Women aren't dexterous enough. They don't have the lung capacity, whatever the problems. But then about 20 years ago, for a lot of different reasons, only some having to do with gender, they started, musicians' unions got together and said, you know, there's too much subjectivity in auditions. Let's start auditioning musicians behind screens. And one of the results of that has been a fivefold increase in the number of women playing in orchestras. Because we don't just listen with our ears, we listen with our eyes. And we know that women are always seen before they're heard. And that's an excellent example of just how prevalent that is. And there have been a lot of other studies at universities. I haven't seen any of this particular universities, but for example, they take resumes of, false resumes, and they give them to, say, faculty, and they say, would you want to hire this person? And they take the exact same resume, and they put a man's name on it and a woman's name on it. And for the superstar candidates, the outcome is almost exactly the same. Everybody wants the really exceptional person. But for the good candidates who maybe aren't great or aren't great yet, if the name on the resume is a man's, that person is substantially more hired to be judged, qualified to be hired, and to be to have the people decide that that's the person they want to hire. The research, the exact same research, the exact same teaching, the exact same education credentials are judged substantially stronger when the name on the resume is a man. So, we know that women still face that obstacle, and I think we're making progress and moving forward, and that's important, but that's still there. So there is a double standard. And then there's what they call the double bind, which is, women have to be tough enough to be judged effective leaders when those qualities are often associated with men, but not too tough, because we all know what happens when it's too tough. Rhymes with rich, and I don't mean switch. That's a difficult balancing act for a lot of women. How are you authoritative enough to be seen as a leader, and yet not so tough that you become, people get uncomfortable with that? How do you be authoritative and feminine? And I think that's a very difficult balancing act. I think we've seen, we've seen a lot of this kind of played out in Hillary Clinton's campaign. Certainly not all of her challenges have been gender-related, not by any stretch, but some of them have. And that's one of them. How can she be tough enough to be the commander-in-chief, but not so tough that we feel like we don't like her? I don't think that's a set of hurdles that most men have to face. And I think this campaign has opened up an interesting kind of window into how we feel about women in positions of authority. We're not quite resolved about it yet. I think regardless of what happens, we'll be talking about the effects of that and what we learned from this for quite a long time to come. I do think women are judged. I kind of joked, women are seen before they're heard. I think it seems trite, but I think it's actually important, and it continues to be something women have to deal with. Again, Hillary Clinton as an example. Is there anyone in this room who's never had a conversation about how Hillary Clinton looks? Feel free to raise your hand. Hair's too long, too short, too flat. She should wear pantsuits. No, she should wear skirts. What's wrong with her makeup today? Now, I think she's done really well in the last few months of sort of consistently looking terrific. But she said recently, I wish I could have back the 2 months of this campaign that I've had to spend on hair and wardrobe and makeup. And I have to say, my heart goes out to her. I know that in my own experience, it's just something that you have to deal with. Whenever I'd say do a morning show, the Today Show, I always get a few emails from my friends saying, hey, I saw you on the Today Show. And usually they'll start with, hopefully, you looked good or you looked great. I'm all for that. And sometimes they'll say, I liked your hair looked good. But sometimes you get, you changed your hair. Let me just say that very bad. That's very bad. Because that is code for what's wrong with your hair. I couldn't stop thinking about it the entire time you were talking, and I didn't hear a word you said. So a bad hair day can be a virtual mute button when you're talking about a woman. When I was at the White House, I think I didn't always get it right, and it became a distraction. And I think as I look back, even though it seems like it shouldn't matter, it does. And one of the things that I talk a bit about in the book is I wish that I had paid more attention to my appearance. Because, again, I think if you don't get it quite right, it becomes a distraction. And if people are talking about how you look, they're not listening to what you say. And I realize in hindsight that there's a lot of women that would have helped me, because this fashion is not my thing. I can't quite hear when I sing off key, and I don't quite know when I don't get the fashion thing right. But you can get people to help you, and I didn't realize that when I was younger. I know that now, and I encourage young women, you don't have to be a fashion icon, but you have to pay enough attention to it that you take it off the table as an issue and that people aren't talking about it. I think Nancy Pelosi's done a terrific job of that. She looks I think if you said female speaker, that's she nails it, and I think whatever problems people have with her, it's not usually related to her appearance. So that's good. Now, of course, all the, you know, the only obstacles we face are not these external obstacles. Some of them are internal. Some of them are the things I think we women do to ourselves. If we don't get enough credit for our accomplishments, sometimes it's because we don't take enough credit for our accomplishments. I can't tell you how often I talk to a woman, a friend of mine or a colleague, and I'll say, or someone else will say, wow, you did a fantastic job with whatever it was you just did. And a woman will say, oh, I just got lucky. Or, oh, really? I didn't think it was that good. Or it wasn't me, it was, you know, the team, or it was somebody else's, you know, who really did the work. I hear that all the time from women. Now, part of that is, you know, women, I think that's just part of the culture, that we sometimes like to share credit or not take too much credit. But some of it is that we discount our own accomplishments. And I think we have to stop doing that. We have to take credit for our accomplishments the same way we would like our daughters to have credit for their, or our friends or our mothers to have credit for the things that they accomplish. I think it's critically important that we find a way to talk about what we've done. And to be proud of it. One of the women that I interviewed for this was Shirley Tillman, who's the president of Princeton University. Wonderful leader. She's done a great job at Princeton. But she was telling me about a time a few years ago when they had a couple of freshmen coming into Princeton that had both won the Westinghouse Science Prize, which is a very prestigious award for high school seniors. And the Daily Princetonian, the campus paper, went to interview each of them. One was a young man, one was a young woman. And the young man said, oh, yeah, my project was fantastic. I knew I was going to win. It was great. And the young woman said, oh, you know, I didn't think my project was that good. I was just so surprised that I won. And I think you hear that over and over. You know, Sally Ride said, not just in the sciences either, although Sally Ride said once that you know, she does a lot to promote women in science, and she said that she sees all the time these boys will say in school, oh, yeah, yeah, C+, I got a C+ in math, but I'm going to be an engineer. And the girls will get A's and say, you know, I'm not sure I'm smart enough to be an engineer, but maybe, you know, maybe I can do something else. I see it all the time, you know, when you talk to people about running for public office, running for political office. Women, you know, you say to somebody, oh, here's the 6 things that a successful candidate will need. And men will go, I got 2, I'm good to go. And a woman will go, well, I've got 5, and I think I'm halfway to 6, so if you just wait 4 more years, maybe I can get there. You know, and, but the truth is that women and men, statistically, are equally likely to be elected if they run. Men are just twice as likely to run. And so we need to, women need to say, you know, I've organized my church, I've organized my school, I've organized my community, I've worked in whatever, you know, business, whatever we've done. I've raised 6 kids and whatever, 1 kid. And say those are equally meaningful accomplishments that give me as much reason to run for public office. I know something about these issues and I want to go out and do something about it. So I think, again, taking credit for our accomplishments is really important, and I don't think we do enough of that. Well, I'm not going to go there. anyway, so I think that's really, really important. Looking around, I see so many qualified women out there, and I would love to see them take more chances. So I think sometimes women don't take enough risks either. It's sort of part of the same bigger question. Another one of the women I interviewed for this was a woman named Judith McHale, who was the CEO of Discovery Communications. And that was a company that had a woman CEO, a woman COO, and 2/3 of the senior management were women. But Judith said that when they would post jobs, she remember one time in particular where they posted a really great job, you know, this job is vacant, and anybody who wants to interview for it, just come talk to us. So they posted, the head of one of the big production departments in the company. And no women came forward. So Judith said, that's ridiculous. There's a bunch of qualified women in this company. So they went around and they talked to all the women who they thought might be qualified. And the women all said the same thing. Well, I saw the posting, but I just thought that if you thought I was qualified, you would have asked me. And so sometimes I think women don't take enough risks. And, you know, these aren't crazy risks, but they're just being willing to raise your hand and say, yeah, I know something about this, and I'm going to go out there, and I'm going to do it. Now, one of the things, you know, obviously some women have. Some women have taken risks. Some women have been first. Some women have gone out there when people said it couldn't be done. And they've done great things. And sometimes one woman can make a humongous difference. There's no question about it. But I think more often it takes a lot of women. I think, you know, more is more when we're talking about women. It takes enough women not just to change the, you know, names on the restroom doors or add a name to the restroom doors, but to begin to change the culture. When I was getting ready to write this book, or in the process of writing this book, and I would tell people, hey, I'm writing a book called Why Women Should Rule the World, one of the most common responses was, what about Margaret Thatcher? And I would say, what about Margaret Thatcher? They say, well, you know, she was a woman, but she ruled like a man. Doesn't she just prove that you put a woman in a position of authority and nothing really changes? She just acts like a man. And I said, well, I think Margaret Thatcher did, I mean, you know, I think she did govern in a way that was very much like her male predecessors and other men that were running the world. But I said, isn't it kind of ridiculous to put one woman into a government that's, you know, almost everyone else is a man, in a world where almost everyone else in a position of leadership is a man, and expect her to change it all by herself? I mean, isn't that an example of ridiculously high expectations for one woman? And I think it is. I mean, but I don't, you know, Margaret Thatcher certainly did not set out to create a lot of opportunities for women. She only appointed one woman to her cabinet in more than a decade as prime minister. And yet I think she did create opportunities for women. She wasn't against women in positions of authority, but I think she did. And Kim Campbell, who went on to become the prime minister of Canada a decade later, said that as she was traveling around the Canadian countryside, people would come up to her and say, oh, you're going to be our Maggie Thatcher. And she said, my politics couldn't have been more different than Margaret Thatcher. She said, but Margaret Thatcher had created the idea, a role of a successful woman leader that made it easier for me. So I think one woman can make a difference. And often, again, one woman has made a difference. But it takes more than one woman a lot of times. It takes enough to begin, again, to change the culture so that there's more than one way of doing things. Because I think that if we expect women to be like men, then I think women will be permanently at a disadvantage. Because as good as we are, women, we're never going to be as good at being men as men are. Men are always going to be a little better at being men. So as hard as we might try. So I think in that vein, it's important to recognize that there are differences. And in the book, I get into the biology, because I think there are some interesting biological differences. But at the end of the day, I think when you put those differences together and you put all those different qualities on the table, we get a better look. We get more options. And for both men and women, I think we get, there's more than one way to lead and more than one way to manage. And I think by creating more than one model of a successful leader, I think that creates more flexibility for everybody. And I think that's a good thing. One of the things I haven't touched on yet is I think clearly one of the biggest obstacles to women's achievement is still motherhood. Because it's really hard to balance big jobs and small children. And I think some of the answers to that are, one, we can and we must have more flexible workplaces. I don't think it makes any sense for half of law school graduates now are women. And yet you get to, 10 years down the line and much smaller proportion of partners are women, or however long it takes, 8, 10, 12 years to become a partner. One of the reasons is the workplace is not flexible enough. And I think one of the reasons is sometimes women don't get the opportunities because it's assumed that they're going to leave to go have their children. But regardless of whether women want to leave or take a few years off or downscale, law firms have, by the time that happens, invested a lot of money in those associates, sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars. It doesn't make any sense to sever that relationship. Why can't firms, not just law, I'm not picking on law firms here, businesses, accounting firms, consulting firms, whatever, find ways to keep a relationship, to be more flexible? I think the companies that have done it have found that they've been able to reap some very serious benefits by doing it. And as the world continues to be more competitive and relationships become more important, I think that makes more sense than ever. I think one of the other things we have to do is we have to value motherhood in ways, and parenthood, but not just motherhood. I think that motherhood and parenthood, for both men and women, builds incredible skills that are very useful in the workplace. I think I would much rather hire me now as having children than I would before. I'm much better at setting priorities, using my time effectively, setting clear limits, walking into a room and figuring out what everybody is thinking, getting people to pull together toward a common objective the same way you would with a family. It's not that motherhood is the only qualification, but why do we tell women raising children is the most important thing that you can do, and then say all the skills that you develop doing it are useless? You know, high school football, now that's a training ground for leadership, but not raising children. makes no sense. So anyway, that's again about that, and I think women, and when I hear women, corporate leaders and others talking about leadership and using motherhood as a metaphor for leadership, it makes my heart sore, because it reminds people that the skills that they learn, they didn't just learn, you know, in their offices. Some of them they learned on the playground and at school and with their friends, and I think those are all valuable additions to what it takes to be a good leader in the world that we're in. So let me give you close with one last story about how I think different ways of looking at problems, different ways of thinking about problems, and different approaches can sometimes lead to a different outcome. As I was doing my research for the book, I came across a story about this woman named Frances Kaiser. And Frances Kaiser is the sheriff of a place called Kerr County, Texas. And Sheriff Kaiser was driving around in a car one day, and she got a call on her radio that a man she knew was holed up in his home with a gun, threatening to kill himself. And he'd had some economic hard times, and his marriage was falling apart, and she knew that he didn't want to do this. So I said, don't do anything, she said, till I get there. So she drove to the man's home, she took another deputy, and she went inside. And he was sitting there with a shotgun across his knees, still threatening to kill himself. And she said, I don't know, I looked at him, and I knew he didn't want to do it. And I don't really know what possessed me to do it other than instinct and compassion. But I went over, and I sat down next to him, and I put my arms around him, and I gave him a hug. And she said he wilted, and he put the gun down, and the other deputy took the gun, and he put his life back together. His marriage got back on track. He started to resolve some of his financial problems. And the story had a completely different outcome, because of one person's different way of looking at the options and what the possibilities were. And I think about that all the time as I think about, you know, one woman can make a difference, a lot of women can make a big difference, and I think we need to begin by valuing who we are, what we bring across our lives, believing that that contributes something very, very important to the world, that it's not just in our women's interest, but it's in everybody's interest. And with that, I'd like to say thank you, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much, Dee Dee. In a few moments, I'll head to the back of the room to begin taking questions. So for anyone who does have a question, I invite you to queue up in the back and ask your question. But let me begin the conversation by asking, given your experience with the Clintons and Hillary's historic campaign as a woman candidate, what kind of president do you think she'd be? What kind of leadership traits do you think she'd bring to bear on the position?
Well, I think there's one thing, if we didn't know it before, there's one thing we know about Hillary Clinton now, which is she does not quit. she is, and I have to say, through this campaign, I think we've seen kind of an ebb and flow as Hillary's sort of tried to find a voice that works for her as a candidate. You know, she started this campaign as the candidate of experience. And I think part of the reason was, again, she had to convince people that she was tough enough to be commander-in-chief. And part of that argument was she's the candidate with the most experience, 35 years of service, ready on day one. And I think, you know, people said, oh, you missed the change. You know, they missed the whole change momentum that's happening in the country. Well, yeah, that's true. But I think part of it was that they made a strategic decision that they had to shore up her credentials as a credible leader. And I think that's been pretty successful. I don't think, you know, there was a poll in the New York Times this morning that said, do you think ex-candidate is tough enough to be president? John McCain, 71%. Hillary Clinton, 70%. Barack Obama, I think, was 58%. And so she has, through the course of this campaign, I think, answered that question, at least for the moment. These things change. And I think that's important. But, of course, that's left her vulnerable in other ways. As a president, I do think that resilience and the ability to get up day after day after day is one of the most important qualities that a president has to have. Because what I learned working in the White House was it's relentless. I mean, sometimes you can't think about it too much because it's a little bit depressing how every day you get up and every day somebody tries to knock you down, and every third day they do knock you down. And so you have to get up and start fighting again. And that was, you know, that was true of President Reagan, that was true of George Herbert Walker Bush, and it was true of President Clinton, and it has been true of this president, President George W. Bush, and it will be true of the next president. It is a relentless kind of push against the forces that are pushing back. And so I think that's an important quality that she brings. I think she brings a depth of policy knowledge. I don't think anybody doubts that Hillary Clinton knows as much about healthcare and about, you know, pick your issue as any of the candidates for president currently running. She probably has, you know, more details of that in her head than it sometimes makes my head hurt to think how much she's got stuffed in there. And I admire that about her. She does her homework. She works really hard. The question that I think remains open is, can she bring the country together? Because I think, you know, the truth is the American presidency is not the strongest. It's, you know, constitutionally, it's not meant to be a super strong office. It's not, you know, there's the balance between the court and the legislature and the executive, intentionally. Thank you, Mr. Jefferson and others. And part of what part of a president's power comes from his or her ability to rally the country behind his or her agenda. Hillary Clinton has proven that she can work really hard. Can she bring the country together around an agenda that will move us forward? And that's, you know, I think that's what the next, I don't know where all this is going. Certainly, Senator Obama appears to be in a stronger position. But we've never been through a campaign like this. I don't quite understand the dynamic. I keep thinking, well, how is Hillary Clinton still in this race? You know, sheer moxie and determination, and who knows what's going to happen. Anyway, looking at her skills as a leader, I think she brings a tremendous amount of skill. I think she brings, and having worked with her at the White House, she's a formidable adversary. I mean, not somebody that you wanted to cross then, and certainly not now. I wish sometimes that she were better at hearing other people's points of view. Sometimes I think she can be a little stubborn. But I do think that resiliency is an important quality and one that would serve her very well.
Hi, thank you for coming and for speaking on this important topic. One of the things that I keep thinking about as a psychologist who works with couples is how we can have the couple relationship support what women are up to here, and how have you seen that happen in your experience, and how can we do more with that?
Well, I think it's critical. It's critical to have, and it's not something that you as a psychologist have a particular knowledge of, although I have observed how it works with a lot of successful women. I'm not sure if it's, well, I've noted, there's no question that among the women who have reached the very highest echelons of public life, CEOs of Fortune 500 companies or the women that are just below that, there's a substantial number of them, maybe between a quarter and a third, who have stay-at-home husbands. I've always thought it would be nice to have a wife. I think a lot of the women, you know, because if all you have to do is work, then you can focus more on work. If you're worried about, you know, who's picking up the kids at carpool, you have to be there, you know, whatever time. It makes it more complicated. We all know that. I don't think that's the only model. Although I think it's a totally legitimate one, and I think families need to be able to work these things out in ways that work for them. I think, you know, certainly that's one option, but there needs to be more options than that. And I think that's why a flexible workplace, and spouses have to be supportive of each other, but they have to, you know, they have to work those things out in ways that work for them. I think a flexible workplace for both men and women is critical so that both feel like they have more flexibility. I couldn't have done my book tour without the support of my husband, who's been fantastic. I generally do more of the childcare than he does. Our relationship tends to break down along very traditional lines when it comes to childcare. Although he cooks and he's fabulous, but he was really willing to pick up the slack because I've been gone much more than I usually am, much more than I like to be in terms of doing this project, which it's been a great, you know, fulfilling thing for me. But again, I couldn't have done it without his support. And so I think that flexibility for families to define what works for them, but to have the flexibility professionally to do it in ways that work. One of the things I didn't touch on, which I think is critically important, transcends the couple relationship, but I think women have to be more supportive. We women have to be more supportive of each other and the choices that we make. I think too often, one of the things that holds us back is that women tend to judge other women too harshly. When a woman makes a choice other than the choice that we've made, work full-time, work part-time, not work at all. Too often it's women who are saying, well, I don't know. I don't think that's good for her kids. You know, she's a partner in a law firm, and I just wonder who's home with the children. Because the truth is, and the women at work do the same thing, by the way, I'd be bored out of my skull. I'd be beating my kids. I'd be so bored. And, you know, the truth is we know, we all know children who've come out of every one of these different arrangements. Great kids. This university is full of great kids who were raised by stay-at-home moms, by moms who worked part-time, by moms who took time off and went back to work, by moms, you know, every possible arrangement, great kids. And we also know kids who haven't done so well who've come out of every single one of those arrangements. And so I think we have to accept there are many different ways to do this. There's many ways to do it well, and there's many ways to not do it well. So we need to support the choices that other women make because that's what works for their family. And I think that's one of the most important things that we can do for each other.
We've now seen a pretty substantial record of female leadership around the world, United Kingdom, even Argentina, Israel, India, Germany. Do you think American culture is especially resistant to this kind of leadership?
It's a great question. I think part of it is culture and part of it is political structure, quite frankly. I think that if you look around the world in the first, you know, if you look dial back 50 years and then look across time at what where women have been successful, it's been more often in parliamentary systems than in direct elect democracies. And I think, you know, even though Margaret Thatcher, for example, was subject to the will of the voters, the first thing she really had to do was convince the members of her party, the Conservative Party, that she was qualified to be their leader. And that's a much lower bar, quite. Not that it was easy for her, but you're convincing a couple hundred people who know you versus a country of people that don't. Millions of people who don't necessarily know you or know what they think about you. So I think that's one of the reasons. But now what we're seeing is in places like Chile and Argentina and Liberia, women who are being elected directly in democratic elections. And that's really exciting because it's not just parliamentary anymore. So I think there's been a change. In terms of our culture, yeah, I don't know. Our culture does lag behind in some ways. And I think part of it is the intense media focus sometimes makes it hard and I think is discouraging to both men and women, but maybe particularly to women who might even want to run. The intense, you have to totally abandon your privacy. What did you do in high school that might be embarrassing because it's going to become public, so you may as well deal with it. I'm not sure how good, I'm not sure how that helps us get good qualified leaders. We're in a bit of a transitional time in terms of the media, and I'm not sure where it's all going to come out. But our culture, even more broadly, you know, the whole YouTubeification, the whole MySpace, Facebook, where people go on these, you know, on the internet and put their most intimate thoughts, you know, and that's what, I don't know if people, young people realize that's there forever. That's a permanently searchable database. You know, in 30 years, that will still be something I can find out about you by Googling your name. That's a little scary, but the broader point is I think there's something about the media culture that also I think is particular to this country right now and is a bit of a barrier to moving beyond traditional ideas about leadership.
I understand your varied career included being an advisor on the TV show called West Wing.
Yes.
Having watched a few episodes, I got the impression that the nation's business is being transacted by a bunch of people literally running around up and down the corridors of the White House. Is that really what happens?
Well, certainly that seemed to be what people thought about the Clinton White House in the early days. You know, it's funny you should ask that because when I went to, I came to work on that show. When I was working at the White House, Aaron Sorkin, who was the creator of the show, had come to the White House to spend some time working on another movie, which was called The American President. So I got to know Aaron during that time. And a year or so later, he sent me a treatment or a pilot, I guess, for this show. And I read it and I thought it was good, but I thought, this was like in the middle of impeachment. I thought, who's going to want to watch a show about the White House? We have the reality series on TV every night. So, but, you know, eventually it got, you know, Warner's and NBC decided to make it, and so Aaron asked me if I would come on as a consultant, and I did, and a lot of my friends said, what, you know, Hollywood never gets politics right. Why do you want to do that? I said, well, it's a really smart show. And then the first couple episodes, I got so many phone calls from people saying exactly that. There's not people running around the halls of the White House like that. People are walking through the West Lobby discussing national security secrets. They could be arrested for that. To which I'd say, like, the television show, and that walking around the White House fast was meant to create the sense that there's always a lot going on. When you walk into the West Wing of the White House, it's very quiet. There's nobody walking around the halls. I mean, especially now, everyone's in their office emailing the person next to them, as it is around the country. But there is nobody running around the halls of the White House. But in TV, that was, again, an intentional dramatic device to create this sense that there's always something coming. And that was very much how it felt working there. I remember waking up, I was sleeping one night, and the phone rang. It was 2:30 in the morning. And it was at a time when we had, I went to bed thinking, okay, we're going to announce something for the crime bill tomorrow. We're going to kick off AmeriCorps. We had this great day planned with all these big events. So I'm sleeping, 2:30 in the morning, the phone rings. Hello, ma'am, it's the White House Situation Room. And I said, is this a joke? Yeah. And he's like, no, ma'am, it's the White House Situation Room. A small plane has just crashed into the south wall of the White House residence. The president and Mrs. Clinton and Chelsea were home, but no one was hurt. And it was just like a reminder that no day ever turned out the way. So I got up at 2:30 in the morning, and I went to work, and the whole day was scotched, and we had a whole another series of questions to answer about why did this guy fly his plane into the White House residence. But anyway, it was always something coming, always something you didn't expect, always something you couldn't believe, you couldn't make up. I couldn't have made that up for a TV show. So that was life at the White House. I loved working on the fictional show, and for me, the best part of it, I worked mostly with the writers over the run of the show, although I did other stuff too. But I got to, and one of the things they wanted from me was, to take my experience and help flesh out stories, really come up with story ideas. So I would take things that happened to me, and particularly for the character of C.J. Craig, and I would make the ending better. So it would be, here's what really happened, but here's what could have happened. And that was really a lot of fun. So it was a really fun thing for me to do. And I love when kids, young people come up to me and they say, I started watching The West Wing when I was in seventh grade, and that's why I want to work in politics. And I love that. That's a wonderful feeling.
Well, speaking of what could have happened, I applaud your premise. I concur with your research, and I love your book title.
Thank you.
Could you share
this is my dad.
Could you possibly share with us your vision of what the tipping point would look like in the United States?
That's a great question. What's the tipping point? Where do you hit critical mass? There is some academic research, probably some people here in this community that have done some of it. In national legislatures, the kind of theory is that it's about a third, 30%, 33%. Certainly in the countries, there aren't that many countries where we've reached that level. And incidentally, interestingly, most of those countries have some form of quotas, whether in forcing there to be women represented in the people the party puts forward or whether there is actual number of seats reserved. But then, Scandinavia and places like that tend to have had a lot of women. And I think when you get to that point of about a third, people stop counting. And I think, issues are no longer thought of as women's issues or not women's issues. If it's an issue about economic development or, you can talk about childcare without that being sort of a pink collar kind of issue. And so certainly that's, I would love to see this country get to that point. We're about halfway there. And so when you get to be about a sixth, which is where we are, there is some theory that things really start to speed up. I don't know if that's true. I don't think we've have enough experience with it to know. Now, in other institutions, I think the number can be quite different. There was one study that showed that when there got to be three women on a board of a corporate board, that things really began to change. The first woman was the woman. And she was looked at as the woman, and she spoke for all womankind every time she opened her mouth. When you got two, there was a little bit less of that. And by the time you got three, women were free to talk about issues that had nothing to do with gender. They were free to disagree with each other. They were free to lead in different ways and bring people together. And they really began to see a change in the culture of the boardroom. So I thought that was fascinating. So I think it depends very much on the institution and on the culture of the institution. One of the things that makes it hard in, for example, Congress is, there are people, obviously Nancy Pelosi has succeeded, and she didn't run until she was 46 years old. She ran for the House after her youngest child was in high school. And by the way, Nancy had 5 children in 6 years, which pretty much qualifies her to do anything in my book. But but for a lot of women, what you see is women do, maybe they will wait till their kids are grown, and then they'll run, and they just, since they don't have as much tenure, a lot of times they don't have as much power. There may be, the numbers may be getting better, but the women may not be in the positions of authority. That's hard. I don't know what the answer to that is other than more flexibility and bringing more women in and giving, I mean, there are women there with young children, there just aren't very many in the House or in the Senate. There are women in both bodies with young children. But I do think, I think more is more, and I think the more we have, the closer we'll get to that point, and maybe we'll know it when we hit it. But I'm optimistic. I think we're going to keep moving in that direction.
Along those lines, we right here at the university, majority of our students now are women. In less than 10 years, we'll have more women graduates than men. The application process, I hate to say it, but the women have better grades. They take more. They're not afraid of taking hard courses and so on. And when the they had a vote in the early, I guess it was 1970, when the first women came to UVA, the men actually voted against this. The students voted against it. But when they decided to have women at UVA, they thought that the men might need to go through see psychiatrists so they could learn how to deal with having women. But anyway, things have really turned around a great deal. I guess my comment that I wanted to say, I speak to women's groups all the time. When I talk to students, they have these leadership, women in leadership things. I seem to be invited to those constantly, and it's women do turn out for them. But the biggest thing we talk about with students is mentoring. It's my own experience. They've asked me who my mentor was, and went, I guess my mother, because I never had a female mentor. I felt, in my business experience, that women tended to be really wanted to knife each other in the back. So what I've been saying to young women, is about being a mentor, supporting people, other women, and bring them up. And I wanted to hear what you had to say about that.
It's a great question. I think it's critical. I think both role models and mentors are really important. I had men and women who were mentors, and they were important to me in different ways. But I starting with role models, because I think before you can really believe that you can accomplish something, sometimes it helps to see it. You know, some women, or men too, see that they just make up their mind they're going to do something that no one like them has ever done, and they just do it. And, you know, kudos. That's a wonderful thing, but not everybody can do that. I remember some of the first experiences I have where I remember seeing women who I later realized were role models. I was in maybe 7th grade when Billie Jean King beat Bobby Riggs in the Battle of the Sexes. And I remember the build-up to that, the male chauvinist pig, and he kept seeing Bobby Riggs with a pig walking around. And, Billie Jean was the greatest women's tennis player maybe in the history of the game. And anyway, I can remember just feeling like, oh, my God, she has to win. And then it was this huge televised event, and she won. And it was like, that was a very big deal to me because, I don't know, it just was, this woman stood up and she took a chance and she succeeded. And then I remember seeing Sally Ride go to space when I was in college. And that was a big deal. So seeing these women, and then of course my first political campaign was the Mondale campaign in 1984, and he chose Geraldine Ferraro as his running mate. I can remember what a thrill that was. I can remember my first convention, standing on the floor of the convention in San Francisco and looking up at Geraldine, remember her white suit and that little perfect haircut, and because we were all worried about her hair, let's be honest. But she, that was just, that really was a thrill. And then I had other women that helped me in my career. I mean, the first real boss that I had was I worked for Tom Bradley when he was the mayor of Los Angeles, and I was an assistant in the press office, and the press secretary was a woman. And she was a mentor and a role model and a friend, and she really taught me that a woman could speak for a man in public life. And throughout my life, I've had women that played that role, and men too, who helped me and were mentors. But as I said a little bit earlier, I realized I was 31 years old when I became White House press secretary, and I really thought that I should have. I thought I was supposed to have all the answers, which, of course, is an idiotic thing to believe at any age, but at 31 in particular, I'd never lived or worked in Washington. And I realized, looking back, that I really could have saved myself so much grief if I had gone to the other women, particularly the women at that particular point, because I was the first woman in that job, and said, "Can you help me?" And I look back, and I can now name a dozen women that would have been thrilled to help me. But I didn't ask. And so I tell women all the time, ask. Ask. And because, you know, that's one other thing that we do to ourselves. Women don't ask. We don't ask for help. We don't ask for more money. That's one of the reasons we're not paid as much as men. There's a couple other reasons, too, but that's one of them. You know, we don't ask for the resources and the tools and the help that we need sometimes. And one of the things we need to ask for is the help of other women. And I do think things are changing. I think when there's only one slot for the woman slot, it's pretty competitive. Any woman that's coming, that wants to, that's ambitious is going to be gunning for your slot if you're the woman at the top of the food chain. So now that that's no longer as common, I mean, most places there's more than one woman, I think that has helped a lot with that idea that there's only room for one woman and that women have to be, are not as helpful to each other. And now what I much more hear from women my age or and younger is that there's much more camaraderie and women helping each other. And I think that's critical.
In connection with bringing women, encouraging women into the public square and our cultural leg in that vein as compared with other nations, what do you think our prospects are for childcare systems, some sort of national system or state systems or publicly supported systems in order to make it much more possible for mothers to come into the workplace and into public office?
Right. You know, I think it will probably, just given the political culture of the country, it will probably happen more on the state and local level. I think there's resistance to one-size-fits-all kind of solution nationally. I think that's just where the political culture is right now. But I do think that there are, you know, we're not as far along as maybe we would have hoped 25 years ago when we were still having the same conversation. But I think we have to continue to push for it. And I do think that as more women move into positions of leadership, not just because I think, you know, I don't think the public sector is the only place. I'm always very encouraged when you go to a company and they have a really great child. I was at Wachovia Bank in North Carolina just last week, and they have a lot of women in leadership positions. And they have a lot of flexibility and a lot of benefits for women, and that's just something that happened organically and in the context of this one company, because partly because the women there saw the need and are creating the process, the programs that will make it possible for other women. You know, it has to be more broad than just one company, but I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all solution, and I think we need to encourage businesses and the government to look for more flexible ways. It's not something that's going to happen overnight, in my opinion. I mean, if it was easy, we would have done it already, but I do think, you know, that, you know, creating incentives for it to happen on a lot of different levels is probably, both because of the political culture and because of reality, just the best way to go.
Unfortunately, that'll have to be the last question. And I'd like to ask everyone, please remain in their seats so that Didi can make her way to the back to begin signing books. But please join me in thanking her for her comments.
Thank you all very much.